Welcome to the Atavist Magazine podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff, editor-in-chief of the Atavist Magazine, and you're listening to episode 3 of 3 of American Hippopotamus by John Mualim. Here's your reminder to, if you are starting with episode 3, you're probably making a mistake. You should start with episode 1. If you haven't heard episode 2, you should definitely listen to that. Now, for those of you who have listened to episode 2 and are about to listen to episode 3, but maybe it's been a while, I'm going to recap episode 2 for you. Before I do that, I feel I should remind you that this is a true story. So in episode 2, we learned about Frederick Russell Burnham's efforts to introduce African animals to the American food chain. He had some ties with President Theodore Roosevelt, who was interested in the plan, and eventually he teamed up with Louisiana Congressman Robert Broussard to convince the American people that hippopotamuses should be farmed in Louisiana. Now, Broussard had another interest in the hippo, which was to clear out an invasive species of waterflower called the water hyacinth out of canals and swamps of Louisiana. We learned in episode 2 of the background of Fritz Duquesne, how he became a Boer scout, how he became Burnham's counterpart and enemy, and how he'd come to America and ended up advising Teddy Roosevelt as he prepared for an expedition to East Africa, how he'd translated his experience in Africa into a series of syndicated columns and a lecture series, becoming a sort of all-purpose expert on all things African. We heard about the proposal winding its way through Congress to bring hippos to America while Broussard, Duquesne, and Burnham established an organization to lay the groundwork and lobby the government on behalf of the idea. But even as the group was moving forward, frictions were beginning to emerge among the partners. Now we pick up the story 7 years later in the aftermath of the efforts to bring hippos to Louisiana and find Burnham and Duquesne living two very different kinds of lives. Here's John with their dramatic conclusion in episode 3.
Seven years later. Around Thanksgiving in 1917, the head of the New York City Police Department's bomb squad, Thomas J. Tunney, asked two of his detectives to begin investigating a certain Captain Claude Stoughton, a British officer who had served in the West Australian Light Horse Division and was now stationed for a time in New York. It's unclear why exactly Tunney had taken an interest in Stoughton, though his suspicions seemed to have grown out of an ongoing investigation of a recent explosion at a warehouse in Brooklyn. City authorities had also been approached about Captain Stoughton by a widow on Riverside Drive. America had entered World War I that April, and the woman was troubled by sympathetic comments about the Germans, which she'd heard a slightly inebriated Stoughton make at parties, and even more so by the style of his mustache. He wore it trained upward in imitation of the well-known style affected by the German emperor, she explained. Tunney's detectives began digging up what they could on the man. They obtained a photograph of him, a slender and handsome man in uniform, and learned that he lived in a second-floor apartment at 137 West 75th Street. But an eventual search of the apartment produced photos of Stoughton dressed in other countries' uniforms, too. Another photograph identified him as a war correspondent for a Belgian newspaper and showed him wearing his hair in florid curls. In another, he sat in tall grass and wore a thick black beard. Another pictured him with ammunition slung over his torso, standing over a dead white rhinoceros. Clearly, Tunney wrote, the man fancied photographs of himself, as he made up rather dashingly. The trove of paperwork the detectives recovered was similarly fragmented and irreconcilable. There was an insurance policy for a staggering $80,000 worth of motion picture film, taken out 5 years earlier, protecting against fires, pirates, rovers, assailing thieves, jettison, barratry of the master and mariners, and all other perils, losses, and misfortunes. There were newspaper articles, piles of them, which, according to the New York Times, detailed practically every bomb explosion since the war began, with a special focus on a ship called the SS Tennyson, which had blown up a year earlier after leaving Brazil for New York. One of the clippings described an investigation into the Tennyson explosion that had led to a British safe deposit box, where police seized $6,740 in cash in an envelope addressed to someone with the virtually unpronounceable name Piet Nyakud. The men had also obtained a program for a theatrical lecture staged 7 years earlier. The cover featured a very small circular photograph of President Theodore Roosevelt in safari gear, and a much larger studio portrait of Captain Stoughton. The captain was wearing khakis, glaring dramatically into the middle distance as though he were stalking a lion. He was identified here by another name, one that had appeared in several other documents as well, including, most troublingly, a letter of introduction from a diplomat in Nicaragua, describing him as a man who had, in many circumstances, rendered notable services to our good German cause. The name was Fritz Duquesne. 1,000 questions sprang up in our minds about the man, Tunney remembered. They started following whatever leads they had. At some point, they reached out to a well-known adventurer in California, who, according to a magazine clipping they'd found, had once appeared alongside Duquesne at a congressional hearing about hippopotamuses in March of 1910. In 1917, Frederick Burnham was living in relative seclusion. Shortly before the First World War started, he'd sold the house in Pasadena and moved his family and in-laws to a ranch in Tulare County, California, backed up against Sequoia National Park. He felt that Pasadena had swollen into a stifling and crowded suburb. The ranch, which the Burnhams called La Cuesta, offered them privacy, space, and some very well-deserved peace. The phase of Burnham's life that had included the hippo hearing 7 years earlier had been busy and stressful. While the new Food Supply Society was struggling to get off the ground, he was also traveling back and forth between Mexico and California, establishing copper mines and irrigation projects in the Yaqui Valley for a number of financiers, including the Guggenheim family, J.P. Morgan, and John Hayes Hammond, a mining baron he befriended during his days in Rhodesia. Burnham considered Mexico the most active region left in the world, the next unruly frontier rich with opportunities, and he was drawn to it just as he'd been drawn to the Southwest as a boy and Africa as a young man. But Mexico, too, eventually burst into violence, and when the Mexican Revolution began in 1910, Burnham was called down to watch over Hammond's interests. At one point, he would command an encampment of 500 armed men on the banks of the Yaqui. The move to La Cuesta Ranch presented him with yet another empty frontier to master and improve, but a tranquil one, on a smaller scale, far removed from any geopolitical violence. He imported white-tailed deer from Mexico, and took pride in how they prospered. He introduced wild turkeys, peccaries, pheasants, and game bantams. The Burnhams were part of a small community of settlers living deep in the Sierras, widely dispersed, people who worked hard and made do on their own. Burnham thought of them as a lost white tribe. When the World War broke, he remembered, it was some time before the reality of it penetrated into our deep canyon. But when it did, the lost tribe sprang into action. Young men filed out of the mountains to enlist and fight. Elderly women walked 4 miles in the heat of summer over dusty mountain roads to knit and sew for soldiers overseas, he wrote. This determination reassured Burnham. Otherwise, he was unsettled by the war. The new technological mode of warfare, the gassing, machine guns, and trenches, had turned us all into military robots, he wrote. He argued that the traditional skills and ethos of self-reliance that those old scouts had taught him as a boy remained as important as ever, and he worried that they were being lost. Self-reliance was becoming an obsession of Burnham's, the only sensible response to the growing disorder of the world. In the run-up to the war, he'd been extremely sympathetic to the so-called preparedness movement in America, the belief that conflict was inevitable and that President Woodrow Wilson wasn't building a sufficiently large and capable military to handle it. Burnham and his friends traded letters about preparedness, extolling it as an ideal, griping about the glaring unpreparedness of those around them. And in July of 1916, Burnham was listed as a Grand Marshal's assistant in San Francisco's Preparedness Day parade. The parade would be a stunning display of civic preparedness, featuring more than 50,000 marchers, 200 nurses in uniform, 500 physicians and surgeons, 200 optometrists and opticians prepared to help the nation's eyes, a vaudevillian actress dressed as the goddess of preparedness, and a division of six-footers, which was essentially a few rows of very tall people, organized by a 6'4" gentleman named J.R. Martin. But the day was disrupted by a terrorist attack. Anti-war, anti-preparedness radicals detonated a suitcase bomb shortly after the start of the parade, killing 10 and injuring 40. It was perhaps the clearest sign yet of the insolence that had begun churning in the world, the audacity it took to try and catch a Preparedness Day parade by surprise. Burnham kept preparing, however. In fact, he prepared more vigorously now. In early 1917, he enlisted as one of 18 lieutenants in a battalion of aging, able-bodied men from around the West that his friend Theodore Roosevelt had begun zealously organizing and was threatening to lead into battle himself if President Wilson continued to keep the nation's military on the sidelines. By now, American writers had related Burnham's feats in Africa, making him a famous war hero, but it gnawed at him that he'd never actually fought for his own country. He thought, at age 55, that he'd finally get his chance. But Roosevelt's army never shipped out. It wasn't until America finally joined the Great War, in April 1917, that Burnham found an idiosyncratic opportunity to serve. Manganese, a mineral used to make steel, had suddenly become invaluable during the war. A scarcity developed after shipments that the U.S. relied on, including German exports, were compromised or cut off. America scrambled after new exports from Brazil and other South American countries, but also took a hard look at its own potential reserves. The mineral had not been worth much during the gold and silver rushes, and engineers now began poring over old U.S. geological survey documents and historical maps, looking for any sign of deposits that the miners had skipped over. Burnham attacked the problem differently. He began rounding up prospectors he'd encountered in his youth. They were wizened old nomads now, but, Burnham would remember, they'd retained an indescribable spiritual quality and perennial optimism that allowed them to wander vaguely over the desert wastes with the patience of the burrow and the imperturbability of the Sphinx. Burnham began roaming the desert with these men, hunting for manganese. Many of them were able to lead Burnham back to deposits they remembered stumbling across years ago. Soon they were pulling manganese out of the hills in Nevada, from the sides of Mount Diablo, outside San Francisco, and from the belly of the southwestern deserts, and sending it off to be bolted into the flanks of the modern war machine. It was the only inheritance this nearly extinct species of American frontiersmen could manage to leave. The desert people's best tribute to the nation, as Burnham put it. For him, it was reassuring proof that old skills could still contribute in a new kind of war. In other words, Burnham spent the years after Broussard's congressional hearing championing the same ideals he'd fought for in Washington: self-sufficiency and industriousness, powered by an underlying optimism. As a young scout, he'd taught himself to stay awake for longer than seemed humanly possible by thwacking the back of his head with his fist if he started to nod off. Now, at the outset of the 20th century, America clearly had problems, horrible and frightening ones, but they seemed solvable to Burnham if the nation would only rap itself on the head with enough determination and force, if it would shout at itself to wake the hell up. His loyalty to this belief was unwavering, and in this way he was the perfect foil to his old nemesis, Fritz Duquesne, who during those same years, the New York City police detectives were now learning, had been slowly shedding his belief in everything. Duquesne had worked hard to cobble together a small amount of notoriety and influence by the time he appeared at Broussard's hippopotamus hearing, and as the new food supply society bumped along, he was determined not to let any of it go. He branched off on his own, marshaling all his entrepreneurial energy to stay in the limelight. He wound up spiraling into darkness instead. At first, Duquesne simply took the hippopotamus idea and built on it, eccentrically. In the spring of 1911, he organized a series of banquets in Washington and New York, likely as showcases for a potential animal importing venture he was considering launching on his own. He served guests a menu of imported African springbok soup, dik-dik, and hippo croquettes. Next, he explored bringing elephants to Central and South America and selling them as beasts of burden. And after that, he came improbably close to staging an incomprehensible publicity stunt for an American matchstick manufacturer, wherein Duquesne would bring over a band of indigenous Peruvians and have them drive a herd of imported llamas across the eastern United States, from New York City to the company's headquarters in Ohio. In 1913, however, Duquesne began planning a more promising business venture, one that apparently had started in earnest but would gradually contort into an ambitious and deadly con. Theodore Roosevelt was now organizing a follow-up to his African expedition, a long, daring journey to trace one of the Amazon's tributaries through the Brazilian jungle. Duquesne saw another chance to capitalize on the public's fascination with Roosevelt's adventures, just as he'd done with his lectures during Roosevelt's safari. He started canvassing acquaintances, and then acquaintances of acquaintances, for money to produce Captain Fritz Duquesne's South American Expedition. It would be part movie, part lecture. He'd travel through the jungle with his wife Alice, filming the same sorts of things that Roosevelt would encounter, then narrate his footage live on stage. Duquesne first encountered Alice while locked up in the British prison camp in Bermuda. She was the daughter of an American bureaucrat stationed there. It was a classic meet-cute. He was resting under a tree, taking a break from his chain gang, when a ball from her tennis game came rolling toward him. Duquesne eventually secured funding from the Thanhouser Film Corporation and the Goodyear Tire Company. He'd apparently agreed to do some rubber hunting in South America on the side, and agreed to deliver the finished travelogue in time for the Panama Pacific International Exposition in San Francisco in 1915. He bought 20,000 feet of film at $4 a foot and insured the lot of it before sailing out of New York, thereby generating the policy that Tunney's detectives would discover in his apartment 4 years later. Apparently, not one foot of the film was ever used. World War I began shortly after the Duquesnes left New York in the summer of 1914. The details are foggy, but President Wilson's initial insistence that the United States remain neutral seems to have disillusioned and enraged the Black Panther. Duquesne's contempt for England, forged during the Second Boer War, was so overpowering that, in his mind, the only conscionable response to the outbreak of the Great War was for America to team up with Germany and crush the British Empire. In short, he hated Britain so much that he would hate any nation that refused to hate it too. According to his biographer, Clement Wood, Duquesne's attitude became, "There are no good Americans except the anti-English ones." Duquesne sent Alice back home on a ship from Brazil, then went to the German consulate and offered up his services as a spy and saboteur. He started hanging around the docks in disguise. From then on, Duquesne would move through life in a cloud of aliases. These included Frederick Barron, Colonel Beeson, F. Krabs, Colonel Marquis Duquesne, Fred Buquesne, J.Q. Farn, Berthold Sabo, Van Guttard, Vom Dom, Fritters, Worthy, and Jim. Some people knew him as the handsomest man in Europe. But now, on the docks, Duquesne morphed into a frumpy and feeble middle-aged botanist from the Netherlands, who walked wrenched over in a stoop and wore thick, unflattering glasses. He called himself Frederick Fredericks. As Fredericks, Duquesne hung out in bars, sidling up to drunk English sailors and offering them bribes to carry rare orchid bulbs to his friends and relatives abroad. But the packages contained explosives. Duquesne would later claim to have sunk 22 ships and started 100 dock fires during this time. Most famously, Duquesne would claim responsibility for the destruction of the HMS Hampshire, a British ship that sank west of the Orkney Islands in northern Scotland, in 1916, killing more than 600 men aboard, including Duquesne's old nemesis, Lord Kitchener, now Britain's Secretary of War. Clement Wood's 1932 biography, titled The Man Who Killed Kitchener, relays as truth Duquesne's totally fabricated account of how he supposedly infiltrated the Hampshire, posing as a young Russian count named Boris Zakrevsky, then signaled a German U-boat to take the ship down. But as Frederick Burnham later pointed out, much of what Duquesne actually accomplished during his time in South America was likely to disrupt outgoing shipments of manganese, exacerbating the problem that Burnham and his tribe of prospectors would file into the desert to solve. That is, the two adversaries still somehow managed to lock themselves in an oblique intercontinental standoff, Frederick Burnham versus Frederick Fredericks, with one man racing to rebuild what the other was breaking apart. February 1916, Duquesne packed the film from his aborted motion picture project into a trunk and registered it as cargo aboard the SS Tennyson, a British ship heading for New York. Then he went about engineering the ship's destruction. Maybe there was no film in the trunk. Maybe it was filled with explosives instead. Or maybe they were in the 6 boxes labeled minerals, which, investigators came to believe, Duquesne had also stashed aboard the Tennyson. But something on the ship exploded as it approached the equator. 3 sailors were killed in the fire. Before long, a clerk who claimed to be a co-conspirator was captured by British intelligence and gave up Duquesne's name. He also led authorities to the safety deposit box and the envelope full of money waiting for Piet Nyakud. Duquesne was now wanted for murder by the British, but before long, on April 27th, word came in the New York Times that Duquesne had himself been murdered. He was traveling through the Bolivian frontier when his party was raided by hostile Indians. Then, 2 weeks after that, a second dispatch in the Times reported that he was, in fact, alive, that, though badly wounded, he'd heroically fought off the vicious Bolivian raiders and escaped. The world, it seemed, had underestimated the tenacity of Fritz Duquesne. But the truth was, there were no Bolivians, and there was no attack. Duquesne seemed to have faked his own death, then regretted the decision, and miraculously resurrected himself. According to Inspector Tunney's account, police eventually discovered that the first wire report from Buenos Aires, telling the Times of Duquesne's death, had been filed with the byline, Frederick Fredericks. By the beginning of 1917, Duquesne was a suspected murderer and a fugitive, a fake film producer, and a formerly dead botanist, and likely still a German spy. But it was taking American authorities time to piece all this together, and Duquesne was either audacious or reckless enough not to care if they did. That summer, he resurfaced in Washington, D.C., and was very quietly puttering around under his own name, trying desperately to latch on to some kind of living. Duquesne connected with Horace Ashton, an old friend whose photographs had illustrated some of his hunting articles. Ashton did his best to help Duquesne, even putting him up for a job as a U.S. censor and propagandist for the war effort. Ashton later explained to police that he'd only learned Duquesne was back in the country by chance. During a visit to Washington from New York, Ashton had taken a beautiful young secretary to dinner. The woman later wrote to him, "You may be interested to know that Captain Duquesne is in Washington, but does not want it to be known." She was Robert Broussard's secretary, the former congressman, now senator, from Louisiana. Apparently, Duquesne had reached out to his old comrade from the New Food Supply Society, too, and Broussard, presumably in the dark about Duquesne's recent activities, had also tried to help, coming close to getting him hired doing low-level clerical work under the acting quartermaster general and director of purchases, storage, and traffic of the U.S. Army. After a while, however, Duquesne must have started to seem like a lost cause, broke and unemployable. Ashton brought him back to New York and let him crash at his apartment, the second floor flat on West 75th Street. There, Duquesne attempted to get back on the lecture circuit. But the zeitgeist had changed. His old material was irrelevant now. The public wasn't interested in learning about African safaris, only in hearing Allied war heroes tell battle yarns. And so Duquesne transformed himself into Captain Claude Stoughton, a nervy and debonair military man who had, his promotional materials explained, perhaps seen more of the war than any man at present before the public. Stoughton had been bayoneted 3 times, gassed 4 times, and stuck once with a hook. Captain Stoughton's career took off. His talks made decent money. His heroism earned him respect, and ladies found him alluring. Interesting people invited him to parties. Duquesne was wrenching his way back into society. His invented persona had such magnetism and such possibility, in fact, that he began deploying his alter ego in a wide variety of personal appearances. Claude Stoughton was a gifted booster, brimming with pep and dynamism, and he seemed willing to promote any cause if it kept the admiration and affection flowing. This even included making speeches to pull in donations for the Red Cross and to sell Liberty Bonds. Stoughton would appear uniformed before crowds of devoted American patriots and belt out slogans like, "We must have dollars as well as men in the fight for freedom." The irascible Black Panther, whose contempt for England had metastasized so completely that he'd gone to work blowing up ships for the Germans, was now raising money for the Allied war machine. The biographer Art Ronnie writes, "It is difficult to explain the paradox of Fritz Duquesne at this time. This is an almost preposterous understatement, but also ultimately as truthful and illuminating as one can be. There's a cynical way to read Duquesne's activities in New York, that he was up to no good, running some diabolical con that would eventually throw the world he'd infiltrated into chaos, just as it always did. But it's also possible that Duquesne simply liked the attention, the performance, and maybe he liked it so much that he wouldn't allow even his deepest and most sinister principles to break him out of character, because his character's life was so much more gratifying than the remnants of his own. Ronnie describes him as an arrogant prisoner of his own ego. He had stopped caring about anything except his own glorification. The Black Panther was an adrenaline junkie, and a nihilist now. There was nothing he wouldn't get behind, and there was nothing he wouldn't destroy." Duquesne was arrested in New York on December 8, 1917. He was charged with insurance fraud. Investigators alleged that, aside from orchestrating a scheme to claim the insurance money for the film he blew up on the Tennyson, he was also running a similar parallel fraud, one that accounted for Inspector Tunney's original arson case in Brooklyn. While in South America, Duquesne apparently agreed to produce educational movies for an Argentine Board of Education, bought $24,000 worth of film on his return to New York, insured it, stashed it in the Brooklyn warehouse, then set off an explosion that burned the building down. Duquesne was held in a city jail for months as the fraud charges knotted into complicated legal cases and the British haggled for his extradition for the explosion aboard the Tennyson. He started behaving erratically. His appearance changed. The alluring glint in his eye turned into something wilder. So did his hair. He started blathering nonsensically. This transformation was met with skepticism, of course. In May 1918, a judge ordered a 3-person lunacy commission to assess his condition and issue a lunacy report. Duquesne appeared at the commission's hearing ranting and unhinged, shouting orders at the doctors who'd come to testify as though he were commanding them in battle. The lunacy commission sent him to a state mental hospital in Beacon, New York, exiling him alongside a man who whistled constantly, believing he was a train, and another man who, Ronnie writes, said he was not Napoleon, but Napoleon's tomb. At some point, Duquesne's wife, Alice, visited, shook his hand through the bars, then divorced him. "It was obvious he had gone German," she said. Soon, Duquesne's body stopped working as well. In court one day he collapsed and claimed to be suddenly paralyzed from the waist down. This elicited even more cynicism from the government, but when doctors stuck pins in his leg and under his toenails, torturing him, in short, to prove he was malingering, Duquesne never once wriggled or winced. And so he was transferred to Bellevue Hospital on a stretcher and installed in the very last bed of a long, secure ward. He had a view of First Avenue through a window with 3 iron bars. He slept with his blanket over his face, and every day, asked to be set by the window in a wheelchair so he could watch the birds. The nurses adored him and would lift his slack body wherever it needed to go. He got lighter and lighter. He read the newspaper with a pair of pinhole glasses he improvised out of cardboard. The birds started eating out of his hand. He wasn't an old man, but he seemed like one. Then, one night, he escaped. Duquesne had managed to acquire two small hacksaw blades and had been quietly going at the window bars day after day as he sat in his wheelchair. Eventually, he got all the way through two of them, and just past midnight on Tuesday, May 27th, 1919, 4 days before he would finally have been extradited to England, Duquesne squeezed out. He'd been faking paralysis for 7 months. Later, he claimed to have been vigorously massaging his legs to keep his muscles conditioned during his twice-daily visits to the bathroom. After wiggling through the window, he leaped 6 feet onto the roof of a neighboring ice house, or perhaps shimmied down using a blanket as a rope. Then he leaped again from there to the ground, and still, even this display of agility, reported the New York Times, did not give him his liberty. Duquesne was then forced to climb a brick wall about 6 feet high and an iron fence with menacing spikes about 8 feet high. Then, after he'd done all that, he lurched down 27th Street toward the Hudson River, hopped a ferry to Hoboken, New Jersey, and disappeared. The wiliness and determination of it all was jaw-dropping. Duquesne had waited patiently until he'd receded into near invisibility, then pounced. It was a classic Black Panther performance. It must have killed him that no one was around to see it. A month later, in fact, Duquesne messengered a letter to a friend in New York, purporting to lay out the dramatic mechanics of his escape. The operation involved two swashbuckling, fictitious accomplices and a foreign sports car zooming away in the night. The letter was a kind of press release. Duquesne wanted his friend to get the story published. Nota bene, he wrote, as many papers as possible. Keep clippings. There are no herds of hippopotamuses in Louisiana. As far as I can tell, not one ever set foot in the bayous of the Gulf Coast. The idea was never exactly defeated, but seems merely to have evaporated unspectacularly over a very long period of time. In March 1911, a full year after the committee hearing, Frederick Russell Burnham traveled to Washington to meet with Congressman Broussard again about the hippo idea. They decided that Broussard would reintroduce his bill that spring, and in the meantime, Burnham would lead an exploratory trip to Africa, scouting out other good candidate species for importation to strengthen their case. He would leave as soon as possible. "We are serious in the movement, and I am confident of the success of the project," Burnham told the Washington Herald. A year earlier, the New Food Supply Society had seemed awash in goodwill from the public and the press, but America had apparently turned more skeptical now. As Burnham gave interviews around Washington and New York that week, he sounded increasingly pained to stress the sincerity and value of their vision. He kept trotting out his imported reindeer and ostrich farm examples as proof of concept. Finally, he just told one reporter, "I have spent 11 years in Africa, and I have had 2 years of experience in British East Africa, and have traveled about and led expeditions into the interior, so I know the lay of the land pretty well. And I think I know what we are doing," and left it at that. Burnham never sailed for Africa, however. He was forced to cancel his expedition at the last minute when the revolution in Mexico escalated and his business partners called on him to protect their investments along the Yaqui River. Even so, he kept sending Broussard encouragement and information, tips he'd elicited from a famous German circus master for shipping wild animals long distances. Photos of the ostriches at Costin's ostrich farms in Pasadena with an assurance that, "If that strange and erratic bird can be handled and domesticated, then the other magnificent animals of Africa could be too." Broussard, meanwhile, made one set of meticulous political calculations after another about the society's next move, postponing the introduction of his bill from one upcoming session of Congress to the next. But he'd soon leave the House for the Senate. Then, in 1918, he passed away. W.N. Irwin, the Agriculture Department bureaucrat, the old man who had told the Washington Post, "I hope to live long enough to see herds of these broad-backed beasts wallowing in the southern marshes and rivers, fattening on the millions of tons of food which awaits their arrival, to see great droves of white rhinoceri roaming over the semi-arid desert wastes, fattening on the sparse herbage which these lands offer, to see herds of the delicate giraffe, the flesh of which is the purest and sweetest of any known animal, browsing on the buds and shoots of young trees in preparation for the butcher's block." He died within a year of his appearance at Broussard's congressional hearing. Scientific papers that Irwin had written continued to appear long after his death, drifting into journals like whispers from a particularly petulant ghost. One, published in 1914, proposed importing a breed of pygmy hippo instead of the larger variety because it would be easier to control. Another made the case for turkey eggs, which even in death, apparently, Irwin found to be superior. Eventually, officials at the Department of Agriculture contradicted Irwin's reasoning in the press, insisting that hippos were a terrible idea, and that America ought to work instead to turn those useless-seeming marshes into grassy pastures, then give the South beef cattle to raise on that reclaimed land. Because people ate beef, because beef was a normal meat to eat. And that's essentially how America did choose to break through the Malthusian barrier that the New Food Supply Society saw coming in 1910. Rather than diversify and expand our stock of animals, we developed ways to raise more of the same animals in more places. Gradually, that process led to the factory farms and mass confinement operations we have today, a mammoth industry whose everyday practices and waste products are linked to all kinds of dystopian mayhem, from the rise of antibiotic-resistant bacteria to a spate of spontaneous abortions in Indiana to something called blue baby syndrome, in which infants actually turn blue after drinking formula mixed with tap water that's been polluted by runoff from nearby feedlots. That same runoff also sloshes down the Mississippi River to its mouth, pooling into one of the world's biggest aquatic dead zones, 7 or 8,000 square miles large at times, an overblown, reeking grotesque of the exact conditions the water hyacinth was creating there, far more modestly, in Broussard's time. Meanwhile, the flower continues to cause problems. The state of Louisiana alone spends $2 million a year spraying herbicides at it. These aren't problems that America created, so much as ones we've watched happen, consequences of our having ducked other, earlier problems by rigging together relatively unambitious solutions that seem safe enough. We answered the meat question, but there were more meat questions ahead. I'm not arguing that America would be a better or more beautiful place if it had imported hippopotamuses in 1910. But there is something beautiful about the America that considered importing them, an America so intent on facing down its problems and solving them that even an idea like this could get a fair hearing, where the political system and the culture felt so alive with possibility and so confident in its own virtue and ingenuity that elected officials could sit around and contemplate the merits of hippo ranching without worrying too much about how it sounded, where people felt free and bold enough to imagine putting hippopotamuses in places where there were no hippopotamuses. Somewhere along the way, our politics, and maybe our psyches too, became stunted by a certain insecurity, by the fear that someone is quietly sneering at us, just waiting to skewer and betray us if we take a bold chance. Who knows how we became so guarded? And maybe it's naive to think that we weren't back then. But the fact is, Robert Broussard's bill did exist. It was discussed and debated. There was a window when anything was possible. Then, the window closed. In retrospect, it's hard to even pinpoint a moment when America said no to hippopotamuses. There were just too many moments when it failed to say yes. In the end, Frederick Burnham and Fritz Duquesne stood at either end of a spectrum where optimism shaded slowly into cynicism. The petering out of the hippo scheme and then the horrible reality of world war that arose on its heels may have been a point when America took a step away from Burnham and toward Duquesne, when we became just a little more convinced that modern life would be governed by the sinister logic of a Black Panther and not the lucid vision of a scout. Some orchid bulbs are actually explosives. Some paralyzed people can secretly walk. Summarizing the whole episode at the end of his life, Burnham wrote that in his memory, the difficulty with the animal importation plan started with one particular congressman's objection. The man had argued that if exotic species like the hippo were introduced for the common good, wealthy, self-interested hunters would simply sneak in and kill the animals for trophies. It was inevitable, the congressman said, betraying a conviction that people are basically sly and opportunistic and should never be trusted. You can call that cynicism, or you can call it realism, but it's the attitude that's given us 100 years of hippopotamuslessness in America. In the summer of 1943, a man named Mart Bushnell visited Frederick Burnham at his home in California. Burnham was 82, still 4 years away from his death and accustomed to visitors. Men who had read about his exploits as boys kept turning up to meet the old scout before he died. They were never disappointed. Bushnell, after his own pilgrimage, wrote, "Frequently these almost legendary characters fail to measure up to expectations, but not Major Burnham. He surpassed even the highly colorful adventurer he has become in my own imagination." Burnham still had a thick head of hair, nearly all his teeth, and a mind that was as quick and focused as ever. Most of all, Bushnell was taken by the same enduring quality of Burnham's eyes. Clear, steady, and almost magnetic in their probing, he called them. Bushnell was visiting on business from the Boy Scouts of America. Burnham was not only a longtime member of the group's national council, but a model for the entire organization, the original Boy Scout. The group's founder, the Englishman Lord Robert Baden-Powell, had been one of Burnham's commanders in Africa and was so impressed by his friend's integrity and ability that he aspired to build an institution to raise generations of similarly capable men. The Boy Scouts wore neckerchiefs because Burnham had always worn one in the desert. Their motto, "Be prepared," couldn't have been a clearer distillation of his beliefs. Bushnell had come to discuss the creation of a Major Frederick Burnham Medal for frontiering and scouting skills. And, he'd learned, Burnham had very strong opinions about what should be required to earn such an honor. Boys, he felt, should demonstrate mastery of everything from stalking and evasion to axemanship, and should have to hike in isolation for 2 days and nights with almost no food, foraging for wild vegetables. In short, Bushnell reported back to headquarters, Burnham was disappointed that the Boy Scouts weren't doing more to put America's youth through the kind of intensive training that the old scouts like Holmes had put him through in the deserts of Arizona as a kid, nearly 3/4 of a century ago. Major Burnham, Bushnell explained, was vitally concerned with the virility of the country's future manpower. America was now in the throes of a second gruesome world war. War to the nth degree, Burnham called it. It is beyond shallow emotion, beyond good and evil, as commonly reckoned. And yet, he argued, not even the worldwide harvest of death need dismay us. In spite of war's present blackout, the future is certain to be brighter than all the ages past. Somehow, his optimism was still unflinching, and he projected it almost tangibly into the space around him. Bushnell told his superiors that his visit with Burnham was one of the most stirring experiences of my life. How I wish every boy in America could feel the impact of this wonderful fellow's personality. Burnham was also a wealthy man now, 25 years earlier, he and his son Roderick had struck oil on an overlooked piece of land between Los Angeles and Long Beach. He used the money to buy 3 adjacent houses in a new neighborhood being built on the bucolic fringes of Los Angeles. Roderick and his oldest daughter's family moved into 2 of the houses, and Burnham and Blanche took the 3rd. Directly above it, on a scrubby, mostly desolate hillside that Burnham said reminded him of the landscapes of Rhodesia, was propped a tremendous white O, part of a sign to advertise the new real estate. The developers were calling the area Hollywood Land. Burnham built a study for himself on the 1st floor and filled one wall with dozens of framed portraits of the friends and mentors who had influenced his life. Lord Roberts and Lord Kitchener, Cecil Rhodes with his dog, Theodore Roosevelt and Gifford Pinchot, the forward-thinking forester and conservationist in Roosevelt's administration, who'd championed Burnham's animal importation scheme since he took his first crack at it in Washington. The New York Times had once claimed that Burnham's story was one no novelist could write because of its seeming incredibility. The writer Rider Haggard did, however, base his most famous protagonist, Alan Quatermain, on Burnham, and Quatermain, in turn, became the basis for Indiana Jones. And eventually, Ernest Hemingway and Cecil B. DeMille would both be working on screenplays about Burnham at the time of their deaths. But now, Burnham committed to setting it all down himself, and would spend much of his last years at his desk, a large, ornate map of Africa behind him, writing simple essays and remembrances. In 1943, he collected these pieces into a book, printed a few hundred copies, inscribed each, and distributed them personally to friends. "Dear Pinchot," he wrote in one, "once upon a time, we took an active part in trying to save this nation from starvation. Hippo meat would now be welcome." Burnham called the book Taking Chances. The title came from an Ohio senator who had said, "It is the spirit of venture, of taking chances, that has built America. Without it, we cannot go forward. With it, we cannot fail." One of the chapters in Taking Chances, The Totem of the Black Panther, was about Fritz Duquesne. Duquesne was now in his late 60s and had just begun serving a 20-year sentence at Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary in Kansas. The Black Panther had reappeared briefly after his hospital escape, posing as a New York City vaudeville critic named Major Fred Craven, but subsequently disappeared again. Then, in 1941, after 2 years of FBI surveillance, of tailing Duquesne on the streets of Manhattan and orchestrating meetings between him and a double agent in a bugged office in Times Square, the government arrested Duquesne as the alleged leader of a 33-person Nazi spy syndicate. The so-called Duquesne spy ring included a thuggish Gestapo operative trying to foment strikes among American workers, an aging male librarian, and a seductive figure skater named Lily Barbara Carola Stein. The Bureau accused Duquesne of coordinating the syndicate's communications with Germany, sending the Third Reich technical information about military gas masks, fuel tanks, airplanes, and munitions, and plotting to start fires at American industrial sites. Prosecutors produced his communiques as evidence. The Black Panther had stamped each with an inky, attacking cat. J. Edgar Hoover bragged that the operation that led to Duquesne's arrest was the most ambitious and well-executed spy roundup in American history, and it produced what is still considered the nation's largest espionage case. In the arc of Duquesne's life, however, it amounted to just another con, a final, eccentric, and ham-fisted epic. His FBI file described him this way: "Excellent talker with captivating personality, inveterate liar, sexual pervert." "His doom fills me with sadness," Burnham wrote of his old adversary in Taking Chances. He had tried to redeem Duquesne, and was still hopeful that some empathetic and perceptive historian might one day absolve the boor by showing he was merely a product of the extreme hate to which we have all contributed, and for which we continue to pay the price. Burnham still kept a letter from Duquesne in his desk in the Hollywood Land study. "To my friendly enemy," it read, "the greatest scout in the world, whose eyes were the vision of an empire. I crave the honor of killing him, but failing that, I extend my heartiest admiration." And among those portraits on the wall, he'd hung an old framed picture of the Panther, too. Just a reedy, awkward boy in his first military uniform, looking sideways. Burnham was organizing his papers at the time as well, preparing them and the singular life they chronicled for posterity in archives at Stanford and Yale. One day in 1944, he came across a typescript of the speech he had given to the Humane Association at the hotel in Pasadena 34 years earlier, while advocating for Broussard's bill. There, in the text, was his younger self, ardently challenging this audience to recognize that the complacent belief in the unending plenty of our natural wealth had now been obviously disproven, but also unveiling an idea that could restore that feeling of promise in America, one that just made so much sense, but would require working against overwhelming difficulties and the loud guffaws of the ignorant to make a reality. Burnham read the speech over. His hand shook with age, but he pressed hard and scrawled a note across the top. "The facts are still unrefuted. Signed, F.R.B., 1944.
You've been listening to episode 3, the final episode of American Hippopotamus on the Atavist Magazine podcast. This story was written and narrated by John Mualim. This podcast is edited by Megan Dietrich. I'm Evan Ratliff, the editor-in-chief of the Atavist Magazine. I edited this story. It was fact-checked by Riley Blanton. It was copy-edited by Sean Cooper. And the wonderful music is from Black Prairie. You can check out our other Atavist Magazine podcast, 1,000 Pounds of Dynamite, on iTunes or on our website or other locations. And we'll have more for you in the future. You can also find all of the Atavist Magazine stories on our website at magazine.atavist.com. Thanks for listening.